Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has experienced teams who can craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex. Real wealth requires real solutions. Connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com.
The latest episode of the Next 5 podcast is out now, and it's all about AI and creativity. I speak to Doug Eck, Senior Research Director at Google DeepMind.
Creativity is part and parcel of humanity.
YouTube creator Danny Vidari.
AI can give us humans new ideas.
And Neil Maiden, Professor of Digital Creativity at City University London.
AI creates a lot of opportunities. I think it's a great leveler.
Listen to the full episode of the Next 5 wherever you get your podcasts. Enjoy.
You're listening to the FT Money Show from Investors Chronicle and FT Money.
Hello and welcome to the FT Money Show. In today's programme, more market turmoil. Who would buy bank shares now when you can earn 6% risk-free in a bank savings account? Executive pensions, why it's time to switch plans if you want to keep your scheme benefits. Emerging markets funds, can they keep growing while Western markets fall? And we have some good news and bad news on charitable giving. I'm Matthew Vincent, and I'll be giving you the lowdown on all of these money matters in downloadable form with the help of my colleague from FT Money, Steve Lodge.
Hello.
So let's start with the money news. This week we saw the FTSE fall nearly 4% in just one day after the fallout from the Bear Stearns collapse and rescue crossed over the Atlantic. Then we saw shares in HBOS, owner of the Halifax, fall 20% in a few hours as traders spread unfounded rumours about emergency Bank of England funding in an apparently illegal attempt to cash in by short-selling stock. So how can it be then that the top six shares bought by private investors in the past week, certainly according to the broker TD Waterhouse, are Barclays, Royal Bank of Scotland, HBOS, Lloyds TSB, Alliance and Leicester and Bradford and Bingley? And how can Lehman Brothers, the US bank that's no stranger to rumours about its own subprime exposure, now be saying that the time has come to change our previously negative views on financials? Steve, to me, this doesn't make sense. How can people be buying into these stocks while they're just falling so fast?
Well, Matthew, I mean, it says that a lot of these shares are popular. These are incredibly widely held shares, the most widely held shares on the UK market. Halifax is number one. Santander is number two. Santander, the owner of Abbey. Some of these banks have fallen nearly two-thirds since their peaks a year ago, their peak a year ago before the credit crunch hit. Bargain hunters are inevitably saying they've fallen so much that they can't fall any further. The only way is up again. At the same time, of course, bank shares have traditionally offered good yields, and of course that fall has meant those yields have looked even juicier.
But there's an old stock market saying, which is don't try to catch a falling knife. And if anything's been falling like a very heavy knife of late, it's been shares in HBOS, shares in Barclays, shares in RBS, all of these banks.
Absolutely. I mean, the bare argument here is that we just you ain't necessarily seen it all yet in banks, that there are still hidden horrors to come. The appropriately named Bear Stearns, was something like the fifth biggest investment bank, has now had a rescue. The scares, the unfounded scares about Halifax this week just show that there is enormous concern in the marketplace at the moment. And yes, we were saying a couple of months ago, bank shares have fallen, great kind of opportunity for bargain hunting. And of course, what have they done since? They've fallen a bit further.
Well, I suppose a great opportunity for bargain hunting if your view is very long term and if you're willing to go through what could be months and months, perhaps till the end of this year, of volatility in the market. Yeah. And you can just remain calm on the sidelines. But the fact that so many people are buying in at the moment suggests that they think that the only way is up from this point on, and that wouldn't be the case.
Well, The alternative, of course, and this is a, you know, investment is a relative game, and an alternative option for investors, of course, is to look at the accounts effectively offered by these banks, and say that because the credit crunch has forced up savings rates, actually, there's some juicy savings rates out there. Don't forget, often, much of the time that people are really into the stock market is when the other alternatives aren't so attractive, when cash rates aren't terribly good. We're in an unusual situation currently where savings rates are incredibly high because of the credit squeeze, because of lenders' need to raise retail funds, despite the fact base rates have started to come down and probably come down further. A cash savings account is the alternative. And, of course, you know, we're fast approaching the end of the tax year. If you haven't got a cash ISA, then that money's tax-free as well.
And if you look at the rates available on some of these bank savings accounts and you compare those rates with the dividend yields on the shares that you mentioned earlier, some of the yields are higher than the rates. But, of course, the risk to your capital in holding the shares is great, whereas if you can get 6% in a savings account, in a cash ISA, tax-free, risk-free, up to the compensation limit, it's a no-brainer.
Well, it's maybe a no-brainer is possibly over-egging. I mean, it's the choice to make. You know, dividends can be cut, and that's a fear with one of the banks, which would mean that yield isn't a real yield, as well as capital values falling. Dividends, of course, the hope is that they will grow over time. So it is a question of, you know, you pays your money and takes your choice here.
And if you want to pay your money and take your choice, you can read more about prospects for bank shares and indeed the wider market and the best savings rates on offer in this week's FT Money, in the weekend FT on the 22nd and 23rd of March, and also online at ft.com/money. You can also send in your questions by emailing us at ask.ftyourmoney@ft.com. Still to come, Eastern Europe, the Middle East and Africa. Can these emerging markets keep delivering investment returns as the credit crisis deepens? And we have some good news on boosting charitable donations. But first, executive pension plans, or EPPs. These schemes for high earners were popular because owners were able to put in large contributions and could sometimes take out more than 25% of their funds as a tax-free cash lump sum. But since the pension rules changed on A-Day back in April 2006, a number of insurance companies decided to stop acting as scheme administrators. Instead, the obligations were passed to the scheme trustees, which often meant that individual scheme members became responsible for running these plans. So financial advisors now say that members should exercise their option to switch schemes to keep their extra benefits. To find out more about how it works, Elaine Moore from FT Money met up with Jason Butler from Bloomsbury Financial Planning.
So, Jason, some members of executive pension plans have been caught out with HMRC compliance rules. Why is this?
Well, basically, since simplification came in April 2006, when all the pension rules changed, the HMRC made a stipulation that people, trustees of schemes, had to actually submit an annual return, basically telling them about the scheme, what was in it, who was in it, and so on. And unfortunately, because of the problems of getting hold of information, a number of the scheme administrators, i.e. the insurance companies that provided the plans in the past, have decided not to actually fulfil that responsibility, and they've pushed it onto the trustees, which in most cases, the trustees are the members of the scheme.
Can you just outline what an EPP is?
Yes, an EPP is an executive pension plan, and effectively it's a pension policy provided by an insurance company subject to what's called occupational pension rules, which is not the same as the personal pension rules prior to 2006. And the reason that people took them out was that they enabled business owners an efficient way of extracting capital from their business for use after they'd finished working. And there was quite attractive tax-free cash entitlements and options for taking benefits. Most of those benefits have gone since April 2006 because the contribution limits and the benefit limits have pretty much become the same for virtually all personal pensions, occupational schemes, etc.
So are EPP schemes a lot less popular now?
Well, I can't think of any reason. I've been doing this job for 20 years. I cannot think of one reason why you would buy an executive pension plan subject to occupational trustee rules when you can buy a personal pension plan and let someone else take the strain for a fraction of the cost.
So what should existing members of an EPP scheme do to meet the compliance rules of the revenue?
Well, very simply, they've either got to fill the forms in themselves each year, or they've got to get someone to do it for them, or a number of individuals will be better advised to transfer their executive pension plan either to a personal pension scheme if their tax-free cash is less than 25%, or to a personal pension scheme if there are two members of the scheme transferring to the same personal pension if their tax-free cash is more than 25%, and that can either be a stakeholder scheme or a self-invested scheme if it's a big enough fund. Or they can transfer, if it's less than 25% of the fund entitlement to tax-free cash, they can just transfer it to any personal pension, you know, stakeholder or self-invested, and they can just do it if they're just the only member. And that's probably the simplest route. But do watch the charges and be very careful about what you're going to invest the money in, because that's just as important as filling in forms.
That was Elaine Moore talking to Jason Butler from Bloomsbury Financial Planning. And for more on executive pension plans, you can read Elaine's article in FT Money, in the Weekend FT, on the 22nd and 23rd of March. Coming up, we have good news and bad news on charitable giving. Before that, though, emerging markets funds. With the emerging markets of China, India and Eastern Europe growing at four times the rate of Western economies, last year many fund managers began to suggest that they were decoupling from the West and heading on their own upward path. But since the beginning of this year, the Chinese and Indian stock markets have fallen faster than almost all others. So where do the emerging market opportunities now lie, and what sort of returns can investors realistically expect? Well, to find out, I went to meet Nick Price, manager of Fidelity's Emerging Europe, Middle East and Africa Fund, and I began by asking him how these markets have been affected by the credit crisis.
I think it's a very interesting question when one looks at the global macro backdrop, and particularly the subprime crisis and the problems that the banks are having, particularly in the US and the UK. And the key thing when you look at this particular region is there's been no direct subprime exposure from the banks. And that's largely because the banks have been so busy lending to their own consumers. There's an enormous amount of growth, and these regions are starting from a particularly low starting point. So if you look at mortgage penetration in Russia, for example, it's only at 2%. That compares to the UK and US, which is at roughly 80%. So the good news is there's no direct subprime and bad credit exposure in this region. I think the knock-on impact is also particularly positive for this region, because what you're seeing is very accommodative monetary policy from the Fed, and that in turn, I think, stimulates inflationary fires, which is particularly good for some of the resources within the region.
But Nick, this is a vast region, and it must have very different characteristics, very different sort of drivers of growth and drivers of the economy across it. What would you pick out as the main characteristics?
I'll give you a flavour for each of the key parts of the regions. Starting with Eastern Europe, one of the key trends that we've seen is outsourcing. This is driven by the salary discrepancies. As a way of example, in Germany, for example, work would receive 18 euros an hour. That's as low as 1 euro an hour in Russia. There's enormous economic sense in moving factories. That, again, increases employment. One sees higher salary growth in Russia and is great for consumer-related stocks. In the Middle East, is the world's largest producer of oil. It has 60% of the world's oil reserves. And one's seeing enormous amounts of money being recycled back into the Middle East in infrastructure-related projects, which is great for me because I can invest in steel-related companies, cement-related companies, construction companies that benefit from this infrastructure boom. Finally, in Africa, one's seeing very strong consumption growth. One's seeing strong growth in mobile telephony. For example, in soaps, PZ Cousins is selling 20% more soap this year than last year in West Africa, and Diageo is selling 30% more Guinness this year than last year in West Africa. So very strong consumption growth driven by investment in resources.
But how long can this continue? I'm sure people in West Africa can continue to drink Guinness for a while and buy a fair amount of soap. But the other pressures that you talked about, the upward pressure on wages in Eastern Europe, that's going to presumably dent the outsourcing story. 60% of the world's oil coming from these regions, but how long can oil remain at these historically high levels? Is this a growth story that's going to peter out?
No, I think it's in its very early stages. I mean, if you look at the outsourcing story, we're talking about salary discrepancy of 18 euros down to 6, down to 1. So I think it has an extremely long way to go. I think we're not even halfway through the outsourcing story, for example. On the oil story, I'm particularly positive on the long run in oil. I'm in the Jim Rogers and the commodity bull camp. And the reason is simply this. If you look at oil consumption on a per capita basis, if you look at oil consumption in Europe, in Japan, in Korea, the average person consumes approximately 15 barrels of oil per person. The average American, by the way, consumes about 25 barrels of oil per person. But the average person in China and India consumes roughly 1 barrel per person. So they are a very, very long way away from the world average, particularly the world's developed average. And when you consider there's 2.3 billion people in China and India, I think that that the oil price has a long way to go, and I believe we're in the relatively early stages of oil's bull run.
Well, you mentioned China and India. Investors will have seen what's happened to the markets in China and India, the way that funds that are investing in those regions have really been hit hard in the last few months. What do you think the outlook is for your particular fund, and why do you think it can perform better?
I'll just start off with a quick comment on China and India, and I'm by no means an expert on that region, but The growth in China and India, I think, is there. I don't think the stock market itself has ran up very hard late last year, and the multiples on a number of stocks looked very extended in my view. And so the correction that we're seeing in China and India is in no means unexpected. But when you look at this particular region, I'll make a number of comparisons. The first is when you look at China's particular business model, it's largely about processing, it's about cheap manufacturing, and there's intense competition. And so when you look at, for example, a sock manufacturer in China, what you're absolutely certain of is the fact that there's another 20 or 30 competitors lined up against each other, and that means lower returns on capital. When you look at a place like Africa, I'll give you a classic example. ShopRite, which is a food retail chain, are rolling out these food retail stores into the rest of Africa. And what they're doing is they're putting the first, Western retail food store into Luanda, capital of Angola. And they're seeing enormous returns on capital. And the reason is there's no other competitor. It's not like when you go into Poland, you'll see a Tesco, Carrefour, Metro all lined up competing against each other. There's only one offer there, and as a result they earn exceptional returns on capital. And I think that's one of the biggest differences. There's a far lower level of competition, particularly in Africa, but also lower in Middle East and Eastern Europe to a lesser extent, and that provides for higher returns on capital, particularly when you contrast that to China. The second thing about this region is that it's extremely rich in resource. It has over 80% of the world's oil. It has practically all the world's precious metals, huge proportion of its iron ore, over 40%. And that's the area that China and India, 2.3 billion people, that's the area that they shorten. And so I think it's probably in some ways one of the best methods of monetizing and profiting from the growth of China and India, which I believe is a long-term secular trend.
Well, let's look at your region now. I think your fund has produced a return of, 15% since its launch in June of 2007. What sort of growth do you think investors can expect over the next 12 to 24 months?
That's correct. The number you quoted is correct. This region should generate GDP growth this year in the range of 4 to 6%. It's a very disparate region, but that's why I sort of caveated with a 4 to 6% range. That compares to Western Europe at around about 2% type levels, and China and India at in the range of 8 to 9% type levels. Valuations look attractive across the piece. If you look at the consumer-related companies, many of them are trading on 7-8 times earnings. So one has attractive earnings multiples. And the resource stocks as well are not particularly expensive, although resource prices are high, certainly by historic standards. I guess where I'm going to here is that I would see earnings growth in the range of somewhere in the range of 15%, and one could certainly expect that sort of level of return out of these markets over the next 12 months.
That was Nick Price, manager of Fidelity's Emerging Europe, Middle East and Africa Fund. And for more on emerging markets, visit ft.com/yourmoney/investments. And finally today, it's good news, bad news on charitable giving. Now, Steve, you know, like the DJs Smashy and Nicey, we obviously do a lot of work for charity, don't like to talk about it. But we do have something that is worth talking about this week, and that's a way of boosting charitable donations. How does it work?
Well, it's also, you know, a hard-headed approach to charitable giving as well. High-rate taxpayers who give under gift aid can actually reclaim the extra, currently 18%, but actually from next tax year, oddly, they can reclaim 20% because of the change in the tax rules. Basically, so let's make this absolutely clear. So currently, high rate taxpayers, 40%. So they bung a pound to a charity through the gift aid scheme. Charity can reclaim 22% basic rate tax. High rate taxpayer keeps the 18% or gets the 18% back through the tax return. From next year, because the 22 is coming down to 20, on the charity can only reclaim 20, hence Alistair Darling's rabbit 2% extra transitional relief for charities. But the other side of that is, while charities are going to be no worse off, high rate taxpayers are going to be better off. To answer your question,
that was a really good explanation of the good news of the budget.
Yeah. That's the general good news. The general good news that gift aid is getting better value for high rate taxpayers from April. There's also an account out there offered by the Charities Aid Foundation, a clearinghouse for charities, if you like, runs a lot of backing operations and so on. Makes it easier to put all your giving in one place and consolidate your accounts for your tax return purposes. It will also top up your donation, as long as your donation to the account, which then eventually goes on to nominated charities, by an extra £25.
So there's two lots of good news. The sort of clawback for the charities is going to not fall, thanks to the budget. Plus extra £25 on, is that on every donation that's made?
It has to be an initial donation of £100 when you open an account.
And then you get an extra £25.
So it's a one-off. It's a one-off. But it's three bits of good news. I mean, charity's no worse off, thanks to Alistair Darling's largesse, ho-hum. Higher rate taxpayers are actually better off because they can reclaim 20, whereas currently they can only reclaim 18. And then if they choose to do it through this account, they open one of these new accounts, and 80,000 people have got these accounts already with the CAF, and put £100 in the account, the CAF will top it up by £25.
So that's three lots of good news and no bad news. I like this approach.
Good bad news.
Oh, there
is a bit of bad news.
Okay.
Inevitably, I mean, we've all heard the stories about charity costs and so on. Now, the cost of opening one of these accounts is the CAF will take 4% off every donation it gets through them for its running costs.
Right.
So,
how does that compare? Is that relatively high?
Well, it says not. It says otherwise the charity that you would give to directly would have costs, of course. But it is something of a hit. And the alternative for individuals, of course, is to give directly, set up a standing order to their charity, whether it's for regular payment or sponsoring a child or whatever it is.
But if you go through the Charities Aid Foundation route, it's still 96 pence in every pound that's going to go to the charity,
plus the one-off top-up. And the key point as well is about the account. It does the reclaiming of the basic rate tax relief at source within the account, which the CAF tells me can help some smaller charities for whom the admin costs of actually reclaiming that basic rate tax would outweigh the benefit.
Well, getting rid of that admin burden for a cost of 4% or 4p in the pound doesn't sound too bad to me. It sounds like very good news. And if you'd like to know more about this and how you can make donations through this account, look out for Steve's Deal of the Week in FT Money with FT Weekend on the 22nd and 23rd of March.
And that's all we've got time for in this week's FT Money Show. Remember that you can email your views and your questions to ask.ftyourmoney@ft.com. And we'll be back next week with another financial lowdown in downloadable form. But until then, it's goodbye from me and it's goodbye from Steve.
Goodbye.
The latest episode of the Next 5 podcast is all about health prevention and vaccines. I speak to Kate Hashey at GSK.
For every dollar invested in improving health, there's an economic return of $2 to $4.
Murray Aitken at IQVIA Institute for Human Data Science.
The benefits of adult vaccination are compelling.
And David Sinclair at the International Longevity Centre.
Preventable conditions amongst those aged 50 to 64 in the UK cost $27 billion a year.
Listen to the full episode of the Next 5 wherever you get your podcasts.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has experienced teams who can craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex. Real wealth requires real solutions. Connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com.